We see that Jesus is in the region of Tyre and Sidon. So he's in Gentile territory. He's not only in Gentile territory, he's somewhat in hostile to Jewish territory. So there's lots of conflicts that goes on with this region and these people. And all of that to say is, instead of doing a deep dive into the background, is that when Jesus is there, the air is kind of alive, a little bit electric, that she's not really doing what she's supposed to be doing. A woman is not supposed to approach a rabbi in this way. You know, we saw one other previous story where one of the women, you know, kind of just come and try to like touch his cloak, right? She's trying not to get close. She's kind of keeping her distance. She wants to keep unseen. So she's not really supposed to do that, but especially sort of this woman from the Syrophoenician woman. She's sort of this mixed background. They're in Tyre and Sidon. And here she is, and she approaches, and she kind of falls down, and she just begs. She's just very much up front, and she's in his face. That's the kind of approach that this woman takes. But it says that Jesus' reputation, when he gets to this region, it says that so many people are coming out to see Jesus that it seems that at this junction, the text says that he's trying to get away a little bit and have some rest, but he can't. These people are pressing in on him, and it says that he cannot be hidden. What is that telling us about what's happening so far in our narrative of Mark? So Jesus has come on the scene. What's happened now?
His reputation is...
That's exactly right. That's the point we're supposed to take. His reputation has preceded him into, outside of Jewish territory, into these even hostile and Gentile territories, so that when he comes in, they go, oh, I've heard of you. And if you take this and you sort of are putting it in the calculation with what we've seen of the hardness of heart and how these spiritual leaders can't see, there's many other people who, even from a distance, they kind of can see. Like, there's enough information, there's enough testimony to who he is that they're hungry for it. They want more of it. They're leaning in, and that's what's happening. They're not rejecting. They're sort of drawing to him. That's great.
I know you can do this, right?
Yes, absolutely. Let's lean into that, because that's exactly what she does. That's why she stands out. She's remarkable. Well, she has the situation where her daughter has an unclean spirit. There's, again, that word. It's exactly what we're dealing with, uncleanliness. Her daughter has an unclean spirit. So Mark emphasizes this outside status. She's Greek. She's Syrophoenician. She has this layered identity. Would have been ethnic, it would have been religious, it would have been gendered, it would have been outside of the Jewish eyes. Yet this woman, sort of representative of Israel's enemies, does something really extraordinary. She seeks Jesus and refuses to be deterred. Okay, that is right, Pam. She refuses to be deterred. So look at her posture. Look at the words that the text uses for her posture. It says that that the people heard, that people came, and particularly this woman, she fell down at his feet and she begged. Now, if you've been in previous classes, we've already seen that word come up a lot. You notice the begging, for whatever reason, the writer, Mark, is using this language to sort of give us a little bit of a signal for who's doing the right kind of begging. You saw people who begged Jesus to leave their town, you know, get out of here. You see some of the Pharisees, you know, begging him to sort of stop teaching or stop saying that he can forgive sins. And you see a lot of these people who come for healing and they're begging for Jesus not to leave, begging for more of an answer. And it's a great description of, well, what the chief parable has been about the softness of heart and the type of soil that God uses, what humility looks like. Pride comes before the fall. Pride is hard ground, but not humility. So the posture of response matters. So then Jesus gives this response. Let me read it to you again, because it strikes our ear so harshly. Then Jesus said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." So I think our first hearing is this extremely harsh? Because Jesus throwing her status back in her face and he's being needlessly cruel and crude to this woman. The idea is something that you can kind of hear a little bit more clearly in passages like Romans 1. Let me read that. Romans 1:16. You know, that's a famous verse. It says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, but what? To the Jew first, and also to the Greek." And it can kind of seem that if you, you know, take that text, is that what he's saying? Like, hey, you're just this dog. There are these scraps, and it belongs to these people first, and maybe to the others. A question would arise in our mind, is Jesus against helping the Gentiles? Well, no, he's already done that. We've seen his trips in the boat. It says immediately, he says, I have to go. I have to preach to these other people. I have to get in this boat and go across the sea tonight. He's healed the man, the Gadarene. He's obviously pursuing these Gentiles. He has not been reluctant to do that. So what is he saying to this woman exactly? And I think this is where Mark is really instructive for us on what has just happened. Jesus is telling another parable. So we've had this wrestling with parables and how to figure out parables and how come people can't understand parables. Well, Jesus is just giving another parable. Perhaps it is said in a way, or Jesus is saying it in a way that she would have expected. He's saying it in a way that perhaps she would have heard before, and Jesus is bringing all of those cultural expectations, all of that uncleanliness, all of that separation, and he's just kind of bringing it to the fore. That's what he's doing. He's taking it as a picture, and he's bringing it to the fore. He's putting it in this raw language that she might have expected. The dogs. Some other people give another take, and this is totally possible. This is true of the language, that Jesus is not saying it so harshly, that he's saying it like an image of a family meal, that Jesus uses the word for dog as little dog. It's kind of like what we would say is puppies. They're beloved pets. So everyone gets fed, and even the beloved pet kind of gets in there. And I see that. I think there's credence to that, but I think the other picture might be more accurate. He's bringing the crudeness somewhat to the fore. He's bringing, for stark relief, this feeling that she would have had of being unclean. And he's bringing stark relief to all the people who have been sitting around his teaching, examining what is clean and unclean. I'm trying to do touch screen. This is not touch screen. But to Pam's point, it's what happens that really shapes the picture. And Jesus knew this would happen. He brings it into such stark relief, and the woman doesn't leave. She doesn't argue. She accepts Jesus' parable, and then she responds inside the framework of the parable. She responds inside the framework of the parable. In other words, she's almost interpreting it in real time. And she says, "Yes, Lord," right? Which is that's what our prayer should be. "Yes, Lord. Yes, Lord. Yet, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs," is what she said. So her reply is remarkable, and that's what Jesus is drawing out of her. She's the first person in the Gospel of Mark to comprehend a parable. She's the first person in the Gospel of Mark to answer a parable correctly. So Jesus sort of throws this parable back at her. She says, "I get it." But that does mean, right, that there is enough abundance that it comes down to even the dogs. That means when I see you, there is so much here that when you show up on my territory, I'm coming running after you to ask you to help with my daughter. My daughter has needs, and I know that your abundance overflows. I'm coming to you. And it might be said all these things about me that I'm an outsider, but I'm running to Jesus. How does Jesus respond to that? How does Jesus respond to her interpretation, her comprehension of the parable? Well, unlike, you know, the disciples who they're constantly struggling to understand, this woman perceives Jesus' meaning. She pushes it further, appealing to his abundance and his justice. Her humility, her insight, her perseverance reveal faith. She accepted her outside status, but she clings to Jesus, and she asks not for a seat at the table, but for crumbs, that Jesus has enough. And Jesus affirms her. He says, "For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." Verse 29. So she returns home and she finds her child healed. There's this Gentile mother whose status would have marked her as unclean. She's received by Jesus. She is honored by Jesus. And she is rewarded by Jesus. Later on, we're going to see the Pharisees in chapter 8. They come and they say, dance, monkey, dance. You know, do some tricks for us. Do some miracles. Show us some more signs. And Jesus says, no. They are not rewarded. They are not commended. She is. I mean, her faith is really to be noticed here. And it's a good illustration of the real dynamics that Jesus is trying to teach between inside and outside, clean and unclean. Okay, so she is a lived out parable. I think that's what we're supposed to see. The reason why Jesus says what he says is to put that lesson of cleanliness in that stark relief. Any thoughts there before we move to the next picture? It's a similar one about clean and unclean with the deaf man. But does anyone have any thoughts on the Syrophoenician woman? John?
So is that to say that Jesus did not hold that position, that he was speaking disingenuous, but maybe I can't find the right word, but he doesn't hold that position? Because I've heard that before, is that he's merely testing, merely being a, you know, merely being a, putting on the affectation of being a harsh person, you know?
Yeah. Well, in one way, the text is obviously not, because he does bless her. She does walk away with the blessing. So it's not, hey, I'll wait your turn and then go away empty-handed. Jesus is fulfilling that. So it's not null and void. It's not that, you know, the Romans 1 attests to it. Here is, you know, this ministry coming to the Jews, coming through the Jews, and yet it's a superabundance. It was always intended to be a superabundance. It was always intended in the Old Testament. It didn't become it in the New Testament. It was always a superabundance. But he's in the framework of that, in their understanding, in the framework of people who would have taught this strong insider-outsider, clean and unclean, beyond the bounds of Scripture, Jesus comes through to regulate with truth and say it was never these boundaries of ethnicity that, you know, you're going to impose upon it. Although it will come to the faithful children, it will always be beyond that.
Would it also be, once again, demonstrating in front of the Pharisees and the religious Jews that he is blessing someone outside of the Jews? You know, that this is, again, once again, him doing something against the laws.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that, yeah.
Which they would consider to be, you know, travesty, I guess.
Yep. So you have, you know, this comment of, hey, you're not washing. And it's a little bit like, oh, yeah, you know, I'll do you one better. You know, I'll go and heal the nations, right? These people who you really think are unclean.
Yeah.
What made them clean? She didn't have to wash up first. She didn't have to wash her hands first. So it's rend your hearts, not your garments,
yeah, right,
kind of
right,
thing.
Right.
Yep. It's an interesting story.
Would have thought to bring the light of that being a parable, right?
Again, that's a suggestion. I think that's that seems like a faithful framework of why he would say that. Given the context and the broader context, he's putting her in a parable, and she is interpreting it in light of that, and she gets the answer right. And a lot of the people can't see that is what they are supposed to see, is the continual pursuit. You know, we said the same thing with the parable of the soils in chapter 4, is that, what makes that good soil? Well, it's the continually leaning in. The very next story is the disciples tapping him on the shoulder and saying, can you explain that to us? And the ones that are sort of chastised are the ones that stand on the shore. They are visibly separated. They don't pursue anymore. And many, it says in John 6, it says that after Jesus feeds the 5,000, many went away sorrowful. They didn't want any more information. They just wanted more bread. They stopped pursuing it. They got what they wanted. That's right. All right, we'll move on to another story, similar story. Jesus heals the deaf man from Mark 7, 31 through 37. If I could get a reader. Nathan, thank you, man.
Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee. in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who is deaf and has speech impediment. And they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were opened, and his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak.
Thank you very much. Jesus, at this point, this is a long trek. It's not too important for you to know. But he's still in Gentile territory. This is a really long sort of, if you're thinking about his ministry on a map, now he's really making grounds. Okay, so that's maybe the one thing I want you to see is if you're looking at an atlas, this is starting to get pretty big. He's gone 120 miles from where he just was. And the text tells us that, wants us to know. He's still in Gentile territory. And then he heals a man who's deaf and mute. It's interesting. If we take it in chopped sections like this, it's hard to see. But from what we have seen, I mean, what has Jesus healed up until this point? Think of just people's bodies. He's healed people with lame feet. He's healed a woman with a discharge of blood. He's healed someone with a withered hand. He's healed the blind. He has exorcised demons. And then it all culminates, really, just a few chapters before we were looking, where he raised a young girl from the dead. So think about, go back to the very beginning of this whole series. We're talking about Jesus is coming through and is symbolizing his what? His authority. He can do anything. And if you kind of map on to his miracles so far and you kind of get to this, you know, the healing of someone's head, their deafness and their muteness, what you kind of can piece together is Jesus has healed like every body part. It's kind of a neat thing. And it culminates in this, he can raise the dead and he can cast out the demons. He can forgive sins. He's the Lord over everything. He can create bread out of nowhere. He can stop the storms. He can walk on the water. And he has full authority. I love that textual literary touch that we see him at this point, sort of the healing of a head. You get sort of the completion of every body part. So then we get another section of begging. People now begging Jesus to heal this man. I think the writer's cluing us in. These people are pulling harder now. Instead of rejection, instead of walking away, they're starting to plead, Jesus, help us. Be here with us. Work in us. And here we see people bringing other people to Jesus, bringing their sick, bringing their family. So in this Gentile territory, now these are more and more of these good signs of faith and of Christ's good work. But then Jesus does this interesting thing. Again, you have this man, he's Gentile territory, but he's also got these diseases. He's seen as unclean. And Jesus just has mercy on him. And Jesus, he sort of interacts differently in this miracle than he does with others. We know that he can, at a moment, just what? He can speak and the storm goes still. He can speak and heal any disease. So the Syrophoenician woman's daughter is demon-possessed, and she's not even there. And he says, go home, you'll find her well. And he can do it remotely if he wants to. But then he acts differently here. What does he do? How does he interact with this man? He touches him. Well, why would you do that to a deaf man? What? He can't hear you. I mean, like, just real practical in the text, he can't hear you. And it's sort of easy. Let's go back in the text. I want to sort of see it together. Because I think it's noticing the preciousness of God, the tenderness of God. They brought to him a man who was deaf, had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking the man aside from the crowd completely, so he takes him a little bit in isolation, he put his fingers into his ears, and he spit, and he touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said, be opened. Maybe the best way to say it is that Jesus is sort of doing sign language to this man who couldn't hear. Like, Does no good for him standing in front of them just going like this, wah, 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 wah. You know, but he reaches out. I see you. I'm going to heal you. In all the little details, Jesus looks up to heaven. He takes a big sigh. Yeah, and just imagine this guy who's just, you know, put your hands over your ears and seeing what he's doing in front of you. It's tender. And that sigh, I mean, think about all the things we've been learning about in Hebrews. That's what is that sigh? Jesus looks up to heaven and he, what do you think that sigh is? Is he annoyed by this guy? I don't think that. I think he's the priest in that moment. He's bearing the burden of an outcast. He's bearing the burden of physical curse. He's bearing the burden of sin. He's bearing the burden of shame. And he's just bearing it. And he looks up to heaven. And that's the burden bearer. Like, not indifferent, not frustrated, not just exhausted and tired, and not, one more time. Like, think about that when you pray. All right, one more time. Here it comes. Here comes Renee's prayer again in Matthew's. Like, no, it's not. It's, what do you find him in his fatigue? Right? The text has already told us. He wanted to go hide out. They were tired. He's going on this 120-mile journey. He's back in Gentile territory. Everyone's rushing and bringing people to Jesus. And there's this big sigh. And the sigh is the work that needs to be done. The sigh is the difficulty of the work. Jesus is, as our high priest, a few weeks ago in our sermon series, we articulated that he's the humanity. So he sympathizes with you. He knows what it feels like to be a man. And you can kind of come to this with this very human, just like the physical fatigue and the emotional fatigue. And sometimes when you're talking to God, you feel like, oh, I need help with it, but you might be indifferent. It's not like you know what I'm talking about. And he's, yeah, I do. And here we have a picture of it. Jesus, just the sighing of a man. Maybe some of that is the fatigue of being a man, but he helps either way.
Austin, isn't the sighing also the hard-heartedness that he's seeing? The disciples still don't get it. Everybody's coming to him to be healed. He takes the man aside from the crowd privately, and then he's going to charge them to tell no one. So we're really getting into this messianic secret part.
Yep.
And Jesus is seeing the full brokenness of mankind.
So I think you're right. And I was going to bring that up later so Mark has, and most writers do, they have these words they repeat, and that thing like that is the sigh is one of them that we'll repeat later, and it will be exactly that point. And I think that it's maybe in tension with this one. I don't know that it's making the same point, because later on the text says explicitly that his sigh is frustration.
Why did he take him aside and do this privately, and why is the very next sentence he charged them to tell no one?
I don't know. I mean, I took that as the sort of pulling him away in solidarity. Not necessarily the messianic secret, because he's doing a lot of things in the open as well.
I think this sigh means exactly the same as the future sigh. I think, the context there.
We'll see if we get there. And I'm not.
He charged them to tell that one.
Right.
The very next sentence.
They kind of they brought him, they brought him to him. They're obviously like, do this one now. You know, like there's an element of like, show us something else. Here's this guy. I mean, the guy. It would seem to demonstrate Christ's full authority in that the man exercised no faith that we could see. Like he may not have been, we can't read too much of it, not have been even aware of why he was there. Jesus doesn't need faith on the person to heal. He has authority to heal on his own volition, but sometimes it'd be like, well, your faith has made you well. And this is kind of like, I'm going to do this because this guy is being used like a sideshow, so if they want to see something done.
I just don't know if the text gives us that. I think if it gives us anything, it says that the crowds are running to Christ. So let's read it. And they brought him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hands on him and heal him. So perhaps I think you're inferring, you could say, hey, Jesus is a sideshow. It's the hardest heart. I don't know that you get it in the text, because I know you get it explicitly later on in chapter 8, where they bring people to Jesus and they say, now do this. And he says, no, I will not do a sign. And he chooses not to do the miracle because of the hardness of heart. The motives were different, so the outcomes were different. And I think here he obviously does heal the man.
I think this is part of that progression, though, because he takes him aside. He says, I will not let them see what I'm about to do, but I will do it. And in the very next sentence, Jesus charged them to tell no one, but the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. That's Mark telling us that Mark 8 is where we're headed.
Mark 8 is where we're headed, and I agree with you. But even if he does it in secret, the man goes back, and obviously he's made well.
Yeah, he's suddenly talking.
Yeah, he suddenly talks. So I don't. Because you do get you get this. I don't know that we're intentional, but we're learning. Like the text is giving us clues to different things. And so when you go to Jairus' daughter, you get a lot of people who are, you know, hey, she's just asleep or whatever. People are laughing, and he's no, okay, y'all stay out here. We're gonna go inside. Now, same thing for them. Like they get to see that she rose. But it was a bit of a judgment to them that they didn't get to see. They had to stay from the outside. He did pull them, the disciples, in. He said, you guys come with me, watch. So I think there's some of that. But we are leading up to that in the text. Now, that is completely clear. We are leading up to this. Some people are seeing, they're being drawn in, and some are being judged and sort of getting pushed out in that way.
Mm-hmm. But he keeps saying, don't tell anybody.
It seems like that is not working, right?
Yeah, it hasn't worked.
It's done the exact opposite. Now, I think there you are getting to this very explicitly. So, I mean, and again, I hesitate, but I would say that would be something I'm inferring onto the text. Because he said it multiple times. I think there's strategic ways. He's also said the opposite.
Yeah.
He told the people across the lake, he told the man, hey, I want to go get in the boat with you. Don't leave me here. The demon-possessed man, he says, no, I want you to go back in the town and tell everybody. And it seems that partially that was successful with the type of thing that it's happening here. And perhaps you could say with some of the hardening of heart, that is what he's saying. Hey, if you're bringing people back here just to get bread, you're bringing people back here. What we want to get to, what we want to get to the public testimony of Jesus is not as a miracle worker. Jesus says that in chapter 1. The reason I'm here is to teach. What we want to get to, what the book will culminate in is the confession of his lordship. And then it will be that is to be proclaimed to the nations.
That's his true
identity.
That's part of why this passage fits in so well with that. It ends with, their testimony is he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Not he's Lord, not he's Messiah, not we have faith. He can heal anything.
It sounds like he's like Beyonce. He wants control of his own press.
I was thinking the same thing, Daphne.
He wants, like, he is...
He's a survivor.
So I feel like a very one-to-one connection is that he does it. He says... Don't tell anybody when it's like he knows they're not going to put him forth as the Messiah and the Lord.
I thought a couple weeks ago we said he did that when he was innocent prior to the crucifixion. Like, I thought that was the whole point. So he was blameless.
I think that's a good point when you're talking to the Jewish crowd.
Okay.
So he's in Gentile territory here.
Yeah.
And one, I think that's one of the reasons why is so that when the charge of insurrection comes, it's a false charge. That's a theory. But here, what Paul just said is this sort of statement is that they sort of stand back and they say, he's done all things well.
And you got to interpret mine. Like, I reject that theory, the innocence theory. I completely reject. So I'm all in on what Jesus is doing is telling people, when you cannot proclaim me correctly, shut your mouth. And it's not an age of mass media. I mean, it's easy to think, oh, the whole world would know because he's doing this stuff. No, they wouldn't if they obeyed him. And if they believed him, they would obey him. And so what he's trying to do is to say, what you're about to proclaim is false.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets increasingly frustrated. It's probably not the right word. Frustration for us has a tone of sin undercurrent. Like, Jesus makes it increasingly clear just how much they don't get it. To the point where he's going to come in a minute and say, I won't even do what you've asked.
Yeah.
That's not the right analogy, but I think about the patience I have with the dumb questions, the repeating at 10 a.m. versus the patience I have at 6 p.m. when you're just like... one's getting this.
And he didn't make a miscalculation. And he should have done this from the beginning. He perfectly designed to demonstrate his authority through these things all along. And there gets a point where he says, I have sufficiently demonstrated my authority. I don't need this. And you use it for evil.
Yep. Yeah, it's a parable of its own. You know, it's the explanation of the soils sort of played out. And if, you know, that is said at the end, the crowd looks around and says, oh, well, he's just done all these things well. And it's either, let's see how the story, you know, they are noticing just the miracles and going, wow, like, look at all the tricks this guy can perform. The irony of that particular statement is that it's almost said verbatim, like Genesis 1:31, which is obviously the text gives us what is the crowd's response, and the crowd's response is almost the way that in after creation, God looks around and behold, all things are good. It's kind of almost verbatim that same language, and if it's said that way, it could just be completely an irony. In irony, in the sense that there is God before me. Like, I'm recognizing the fruit of creation. Like, there's a guy who's like ex nihilo, you know, taking spit and, you know, healing organs. Oh, wow, look, you know, we redo this phrase we've known since our childhood. Hey, look, you know, he does things, all things well, all things good. Look around, all things are done well. So they... what does it leave us with? It leaves us this impression that at least they should get it, but perhaps they don't. Okay, so that's kind of the where we're left with this particular crowd. So let's read a little bit more. We'll get to the feeding of 4,000. We'll try to wrap up in about 10 minutes. So we're in chapter 8. We'll read verses 1-10. Andrew, do you have that? Thank you.
In those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd, because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from far away. And his disciples answered him, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? And he asked them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them, gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went into the district of Dalmanutha.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. We will accept it. So this is the second bread miracle. And it's really easy when you're reading, you're like, wait, there was another one like one page ago. You know, and it seems that they still don't get it. Like, what's the deal with that? And I forgot to say this earlier, but the first bread miracle came right after Herod's feast. Remember the sort of horrific feast where they kill John the Baptist, and there's this great sort of like, hey, in this man's house, in this man's feast, this is the kind of debauchery, this is the kind of death that comes from it. And I forgot to mention just from a literary structure, just the beauty of Jesus' feast afterward. Like, there's this politician's feast, and it ends in manipulation, destruction, and like people getting pulled by money and wealth and power, and here's Jesus' feast, everyone being fed in abundance and in peace and giving life. But it says that Jesus had great compassion on the crowd. So, you know, again, we're sort of wrestling with, there's the size. We know that the size are there, they're present. So what are they for? Well, he still has compassion on them. And so he sits them down. So notice the disciples, they come to the same doubt they had the first time. But it might be fair here to say, one, I don't know why they doubt. They're like, hey, how are we going to feed these people? Well, we just did that with a larger crowd. So it's perhaps that these are different disciples in the sense of Jesus' disciples we know are growing. They're broader than the 12. Perhaps it is a different group of people who ask a similar question. But regardless, well, look, this time there are 7 loaves. And then we see Jesus just in this beauty again. I think we're seeing him as priest. What does he do with the bread? He takes the bread, he breaks the bread, he blesses the bread, and he gives thanks, and he gives it to the people. And it's a similar pattern to the Lord's Supper. It's a similar pattern to the way that Jesus is going to minister to us later today. Jesus has compassion on the crowd. He sits them down. He gives them peace. He gives them abundance. So all were ate. We know that all the people were satisfied. And again, symbolically, there was more than enough. Okay, so the collection kind of comes around. There went from this scarcity to superabundance. Everyone's, you know, their belly's aching. We can't eat another bite. We'll go ahead and, you know, let's clean up the tables. What comes back? Well, 7 loaves this time, and 7 baskets are left over. But why? Why are there 2 bread miracles? Well, the first one was done in Jewish territory. That's the crowd that he was dealing with at the time. And so when the 12 baskets were left over, we noted that it was to likely encourage, you know, this is the 12 sort of new foundations of the church, sort of in this Jewish territory. 12 is pretty symbolic of the 12 tribes of Israel, and we can see that later on in Revelation where they're, you know, the sort of the foundations are these fathers of the Jewish faith and the 12 apostles. So that's where they were in that Jewish territory. But what do we know about the Syrophoenician woman? How did she get the parable right? Even the dogs eat the crumbs, right? Even the dogs get the superabundance. Even the dogs gets what are left over. That's what the people thought of themselves. Jesus is here sort of embodying that. They do give the overflow. The second miracle is done in Gentile territory, and Jesus is not snubbing them. So like their expectation, right? That sort of parable that he throws back in the face. Right? We call ourselves dogs, what we expect to be. That's what we're called. That's what we know ourselves to be. Well, he's not snubbing them at all. He's giving to them. He's having compassion on them. He's not rude or withholding from them. And so that the bread that's collected back over is 7 baskets full. And so it usually just in numerology, that number 7 is that number of completeness. So we have, you know, we have this superabundance for the children, right? To put it back in the parable of that he tells the Syrophoenician woman, there is enough for the children in the house. And then there's 7 baskets left over in the Gentile territory. There's enough for everybody. And that's the parable that she got right, that he just enacted in another way for them to see. So it's the fullness of Jesus' provision that he's going to give to the whole world. Yes, that clock is wrong. Okay. So for sake of time, any thoughts, questions as we kind of wrap up? Well, yeah, go ahead, Andrew.
When we think about the compassion of Jesus and the compassion of God, so verse 2, he's showing compassion for a physical need, it seems, like they're hungry. Mm-hmm. But obviously, like, I wouldn't want to separate Jesus' compassion for physical needs from his like compassion for us being lost in our sin and dead in our sin. So, what's the best way to kind of think about meeting people's physical needs and being compassionate in that sense, but not separating them from their spiritual needs? Like, did the question answer itself?
A little bit.
Okay.
You know.
What do you mean by separating?
I can kind of imagine myself or someone kind of picking this text and saying, oh, it looks like Jesus is very, you know, like, he wants to feed hungry people. So that's what the mission of Jesus mm-hmm. is. And obviously you have to have a more, like, well-orbed, like, you have to understand the whole Bible and what it's talking about. But I just think it's easy sometimes to look at something like that and say, if I just meet physical needs, I'm doing God's work without for me, sometimes I can separate them, I think.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm not saying it's good.
Right, right. And Jesus gives
them. Don't separate them. There are 2 different needs.
So there's not. Here's the way to ask it. If you've got two ministries, or no, 2 charities, you have a Christian ministry that's focused on spiritual stuff.
I think the difference is this is a moment.
Okay.
In a moment, somebody's hungry. What good is it to say, you know, I'll pray for you, go and be well, when they go home starving again?
Yeah.
I think in a moment you're allowed mm-hmm. to just give somebody some bread and some fish. Yeah. In the context of a ministry, you're helping the whole person.
And Jesus obviously never stopped there. And what he does put a stop to is the soup kitchen. Like later on, he's don't come back here for more bread.
Okay.
And he has a big advantage. When he feeds them, it is teaching a spiritual reality.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of like liberal churches, like in the PCUSA, have kind of turned into we've got this
right.
food shelter for mm-hmm. or, you know, food for homeless people type of deal.
They've confused a ministry with a moment, I would say.
Okay.
But I don't know about the language of separation because sometimes you just have to feed people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And I think that's the kind of thing that they wouldn't be willing to do that Jesus later on does do is say like
repent and believe yeah.
and like this isn't perpetual just a food bank
yeah.
you know and not to say that that's normative for all of our practices but I
right.
Let me read because we already brought it up. This will help us, and I can do it in time. Look at verses 11 through 13. The Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and says, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. And he left them, got into a boat again, and went to the other side. So they had just seen multiple signs that attest to that he's the Son of God. Yet they're demanding again, sort of dance, monkey dance, show us one more sign. And he knows that it's a test. And so Jesus sighs again here, like we sort of talked about. But here it is explicitly irritation. He is frustrated about the hardness of heart, and he's not feeling compassion on the needy. In fact, these people are not needy. So you have people who come to him and say, perform this sign, I need your help. There's deafness, there's brokenness, there's uncleanness. So when the Pharisees come, what are they saying they need help with? Like that, they're really not coming with a need at all. They're coming with a test. So Jesus does give freely to the needy crowds, but he refuses to dance for the Pharisees who are not in need. So they are trying to judge Jesus, and this is a good place for us to end. And as we move forward, we'll see that increasingly he is going to now be their judge. So they're trying to judge him, and now his rejection of that, he's not playing along anymore, never was, but he is increasingly going to make it clear that he is their judge.